It's a great privilege to have with us Mr. Blair Cumley, who is the Deputy Secretary in the Department of Climate Change, and he has executive oversight for the design and implementation of the emissions trading system and matters related to renewable energy emissions inventory and projections. Blair previously held a range of senior positions in the Treasury, including business tax, indirect tax, and in macroeconomic policy. Also, particularly relevant to this exercise, the debt management review team, which brings his markets experience into play in an area where it's going to count in emissions trading. Blair represented Australia for 3 years on economic matters at the OECD and was the acting chief executive officer of the Australian Office of Financial Management, with responsibility for managing the Australian government's debt and related derivatives portfolio. He's worked on competition policy, environment policy, and welfare reform. And before joining Treasury in 1994, Blair worked at the Industry Commission and was a lecturer in the Department of Economics at Monash University. He's going to talk to us today about the government's green paper on climate change. I've had discussions with him that indicate that if it's worth knowing, he knows it. He's the expert on this topic, and I'm very pleased we can welcome him here today. Please join me in welcoming to the platform.
Thanks very much. Okay, well, what I thought I'd do, I did have a good discussion with Fred about what we should cover. He assured me you were all experts, and so I could skip the 20 introductory slides and start at slide 21. So if it's impenetrable, I'll take partial responsibility, but pass some on to Fred. He also indicated that for this audience, you would be particularly interested in how the carbon market itself might work and how some of the price parameters, etc., might play. And so what I thought would be really, I would try and do, is largely give a presentation on the nature of the policy, but try and give you an insight as to what the trade-offs were where we landed on certain design elements in the green paper, okay? Because I think that's important in this whole process. Now, a key point here is that achieving a low carbon economy is a major economic reform. And I suppose it's obvious that I'm going to say that given my background, but I think about this as there's a very substantial environmental driver that motivates you to do things on greenhouse issues. But fundamentally, once you've decided to do it, you're talking about a structural transformation of the economy. And so you really have to think about that in the same way that you would think about economic reform processes elsewhere. The first observation that leads you to is this is very much like when you're dealing with tax reform, when you're thinking about broad bases and low rates, if you like. That is, that the widest possible effort, the more you spread the burden of an adjustment, the lower the cost is likely to be. So when you think about it at a very highest level, if I exclude or shield a sector from the requirement to reduce emissions, I must be increasing the relative burden on the sectors that are left in the emissions reduction task. Now, what that would translate into effectively in a pricing sense is the more I shield, I'm going to tend to have a higher price in the other sectors because that's then required to drive the higher level of abatement. The other thing about major economic reforms, if you look about all the major economic reforms in Australia, we don't turn the tap on overnight. We don't jump from one regime to another. We typically have a graduated transition and we typically pay an enormous amount of attention to the transitional assistance required for businesses and households. And that's really part almost of the social economic compact, that you don't change the rules of the game immediately overnight. And you think of tariff reform, etc. These are processes that started off many years. They were sort of launched in the late 80s, but there was quite a long implementation timetable as you rolled out phased reductions in tariffs. So one of the commitments that sort of highlights this is the government said it will recycle every cent of revenue to assistance to households and businesses. Now, interestingly enough, it wouldn't surprise you that the bids for the revenue exceed the amount of revenue that's likely to be generated. I don't think that would surprise anyone. But that's the world we'll be in. Now, I'll just start with reporting and compliance, because I've skipped the mechanics of how... I think I've skipped the mechanics of how the scheme operates. But very basically, how does a cap-and-trade scheme work? Well, you start with a firm making some emissions, putting out some carbon pollution, so-called, in the atmosphere. Now, we're using the term carbon pollution as a proxy for the greenhouse gases that affect global warming. There are six gases. The majority is made up with carbon dioxide and methane in terms of the effect on the atmosphere. Firms emit into the atmosphere, and what the cap and trade scheme says, you have to monitor and report those emissions, and for every tonne of emissions, you will have a permit liability. You'll have to remit a permit to the regulator at the end of the year. Now, what that effectively means is I've got these permits matching emissions, and then I set a cap which is below the level that business would normally want to admit in a business as usual scenario. So the permits become scarce, and they're in a situation where the price of permits will rise until such time as you'll meet the cap on emissions. So that's the basic mechanism. So from a firm level, you just look at the emissions going to the atmosphere, and in that circumstance, you have to have a permit liability. Now, the best explanation I've seen this is actually on a kids program, which screened 5 days after the Green Paper was put out, which had a lovely little clip with 2 8-year-old kiddies and some wheelie bins. And it said, imagine that the carbon pollution is a bit like the garbage bags you have to put in the wheelie bins, and suddenly the council takes away one of the wheelie bins you had before. And so they've taken the wheelie bin away, and you've got one kid standing there with a wheelie bin, crammed full, can't fit all the garbage bags in. Another 8-year-old kiddie on the side with a bit of excess space in their wheelie bin. You know, they've got some space to sell, and they trade the capacity to put. They sell their spare space for $20 to the second 8-year-old kiddie who puts their garbage bag into the wheelie bin. That's essentially how the cap-and-trade scheme works. Now, obviously, to make a cap-and-trade scheme work like that, you need to be able to penalise the 8-year-old kiddie who just decides to leave the garbage bag on the side of the walk and not in the limited wheelie bins. So what we have is the National Greenhouse Energy Reporting System, which started 1 July this year. It has emissions reporting systems, and there's a single report for both, will be for ENGAs and emissions trading. Scheme obligations will go on operational control, and there's assurance mechanism. Now, the slide that I've skipped, because Fred assured me you're all experts, is just to explain that in the scheme, the way you get very large coverage is, if you think about the most intuitive way of putting permit liability, it would be when the emissions enter the atmosphere. You know, when your emission hits the atmosphere, say you've got to pay a permit. Now, that works for large emitters because they've got sophisticated enough systems to track it. And so what we say is, if you've got more than 25,000 tonnes of emissions a year, you have to report directly your emissions. But if you think about how that obvious point of liability would work, say, for a motor vehicle, everyone who drives a motor vehicle would have an emission liability and have to buy a permit, because when you combust the fuel is when it enters the atmosphere. Clearly, that's not an administratively very sensible thing to do. But it turns out that there is a very tight technical relationship between the litres of fuel used and the amount of emissions that hit the atmosphere. So you just go back up the supply chain through the motor vehicle to the service station, to the distributor, up to the importer and refiner, until you find an administratively convenient point at which to put the obligation on, because that will then map to the emissions actually into the atmosphere. So with a combination of direct and upstream liability, you can cover 75% of emissions with only about 1,000 firms being direct liable parties within the scheme. Okay. Now, if you come back to my can the kid leave the garbage bag on the pavement and your compliance and enforcement mechanisms, the fact that your target compliance market is only 1,000 firms gives you a pretty good chance of being able to hit your actual cap. So in the cap and trade scheme, the cap sets a level of emissions, and the easiest way to think about it is the cap achieves the environmental objective. And then the trade ensures that the people who value those emissions or the permits the most can get hold of them. They're not stuck with where they're first allocated. Now, I know you're interested in reporting compliance. There's a big debate that we had before the Green Paper, which was, should all emissions data that's to be handed to the regulator be required to be third-party audited before it's submitted. Okay? Now, if you think about, for example, the tax system, we don't require that in the tax system. You lodge your tax return to the Commissioner of Taxation. There's no requirement that you've got some third-party audit on that. The Commissioner then undertakes a risk-based audit of whether the data is accurate and can come back with compliance penalties. Now, many people have argued that's not the right model for an emissions trading scheme. And one of the reasons they've argued that is you can think about an emissions trading scheme as a bit like having two components. The first component looks very much like an indirect tax. That is, you have some basis on which you're going to be levied a fee, in this case permits. That has the amount of that has to be assessed, and then you have to pay buy permits, effectively pay a fee. That looks like an indirect tax. But the second element is, because I've created these permits, I'm going to create a financial market associated with those permits, which are traded. Now, when you think about the financial market aspect of an ETS, you get very nervous about dodgy information being floating around in the financial market. So people who focus on more of an ETS as a financial market are very concerned that the data the regulator might release after it's got these returns on what the emissions have been, which is going to be an indicator of likely future price pressures, is audited, verified in a reasonable way. So what the Green Paper does is say, let's strike a balance between those two. In the long term, we might move to a situation where everyone needs a third-party audit before they put in their information to the regulator. But there's a question mark over what the auditing capacity in the private sector might be at the start-up of the scheme. It's sort of a transitional issue. And so a balance could be struck between having emitters with 125,000 tonnes of emissions requiring third-party audit, with a view to see how auditing capacity develops, and you may in fact move that down over time. The other thing about reporting and compliance is the plans have a staged improvement in the methodologies used. Under the National Greenhouse Energy Reporting Scheme, there are often a range of methodologies you can use for estimating emissions. So at one level, you might have a method which are often referred to as default factors. So it might just be a crude proxy based on some other piece of information that you already collect. So, for example, it might be the tons of steel you produce. There's a known relationship, at least on average, to how many emissions that might produce. At the other end might be actual direct emissions. You might almost put a tailpipe measuring device and formally record on a continuous basis the emissions going out. So the idea is to have a staged improvement over time. Now, in terms of the compliance timeline, financial year basis, compliance starts on 1 July in each year. Let's see if this works. Okay. This is always dangerous for Fred, because you get this in the eye, it's actually quite dangerous. 1 July, the year starts. 30 June is the end of the compliance period. Final date for lodgement of emissions data is 31 October, so a reasonable period after the close of the year. Then as soon as possible after 31st of October, there'll be public release of scheme emissions information by the regulator, which comes back to this pre-auditing issue. You're going to have data out there that, in a sense, hasn't been checked, partly because normal audit procedures or risk assessment will take quite some time after this, because you have to work out where you want to hit, where the client profiling would be done, etc. Then, by the 15th of December, is the final date for surrender of the permits, which extinguish your liability under the scheme. And then the compliance year starts again. Now, we have had a lot of people, particularly from financial markets, who've said, look, one annual release of data is not really enough information if we're on a continuous pricing in the secondary market. Can we do more? And one of the things that's been put in submissions is, could the regulator require quarterly or six-monthly provide information from liable party, which would then be collated and released in terms of the provision of the market? We're having a look at that. It's obviously a balance between the information and the compliance costs. The other issue to bear in mind is, whilst there may not be emissions data under this model being put to the regulator and released more than annually, there is a lot of other data out there that would give you a hint as to what's happening with the emissions profile in the economy. So, for example, if you are monitoring the electricity market the national electricity market, you could get information about the amount of electricity dispatched and some profile of who dispatched it, which tells you something about emissions. You can get information about the amount of excise collections from the fuel industry, which gives you an indication of how much fuel... You know, there's a range of other partial indicators. So it's not an all or nothing, you only get one set of data a year. It's a bit like other financial markets. There's partial data that's provided that analysts will pore over, and probably some in this room will earn good fees finding a way of describing them. Caps and gateways. Obviously, if you have a cap and trade scheme, a pretty important thing is what the cap is. Now, the Green Paper does not specify the numerical targets for the cap, but what it does do is set out the architecture for how much information the government will provide in advance of what the scheme caps and gateways will be. Now, clearly here, there is a trade-off between business certainty and flexibility on the part of the government for specifying caps a long way in advance. So the longer you specify the cap in advance, the more certainty you provide to business making longer-term investments about what the likely carbon price is. Now, it's worth dwelling on that, the likely carbon price, because you might have quantity information, but you don't have price information from just knowing what the scheme cap is. On the other hand, the longer you lock yourself in saying this will be the scheme cap, the less the government has flexibility to respond to either evolving international negotiations or developments in climate science. So there's a trade-off. Now, some submissions would like the government to provide 30 years of certainty about caps, okay? And they argue that, look, we make investments over 30, 40-year time horizons, so we'd like that. And you can understand that, but 30 years is a long time in an evolving policy debate to lock yourself in. So the government set the balance in the following way. You start with the national emissions trajectory, and the idea is to specify that for 5 years. So you'd know what the national emissions trajectory is for 5 years. The scheme caps then become a function of the national emissions trajectory. The scheme cap's less than the emissions trajectory because you don't have 100% coverage. And the key gap at the start of the scheme is agriculture is not included. So that's why you get about 75% of emissions. Agriculture not included, and the government said it won't include it to at least 2015. The scheme cap will be announced for 5 years. So you'll get, say, at 2010, you'll get from 2010 to 2015. From 2015... You'll then get what is known as a gateway. So in a sense, you'll get a range within which the scheme cap will be set for another 10 years. So you have 15 years of information of where the cap would lie, 5 years of the actual cap, and 10 years, if you like, a cone within which the scheme caps will be set. Each year as you move through time, another year of the scheme cap will be popped out, so you always have 5 years on a rolling basis. These ranges here, the so-called gateways, won't be updated every year. What will happen is every 5 years you'll do a major independent review of where the gateways should be set, okay, because it's sort of a very big decision where you set gateways. So as you move through time from 2010 to 2015, you start to reduce the number of years at which you have information about the likely gateway. But at 2015, or just around that time, I then pop out a new gateway at 2030. So my level of information concertinas between 10 years and 15 years. Okay. Now, operation of the carbon market. Obviously, expectations of future carbon prices will drive investment and behavioural change. So you need to create a robust, credible carbon market. And so the government proposes that these will have the status of property rights. In other words, you'll get protection if the government later on decides to cancel them, as if we've acquired property. And the registry will record all the holdings of these property rights. Permits will be banked indefinitely, can be banked indefinitely. That's an important point. Now, in the jargon here, each of the permits will have a vintage, a date stamp. So it could be over 2010. So 2010, very good year, you know, good growing conditions. 2010, 2011, 2012, etc. And the permit can be used in that year or any year after that. Now, that's a very important design feature. It's important from an economic point of view because if you had single-year vintages, in a sense, the government would have to know precisely what the pattern of emissions reductions over time would be in a much more precise way. And in fact, if you looked at the European Union scheme, one of the initial problems with their first phase was it was, in a sense, a first phase that ended, and there was no carryover of permits to the second phase. So by implication, the price basically had to fall to zero if there are any unused permits at the end of that phase. Whereas if they're banked, you would expect that the markets in each year are linked together and people can effectively choose the lowest cost form of abatement, both in any particular period but across time as well. So what you would expect with indefinite banking is that you would end up with a forward price curve for these vintages, which would rise in line with what sort of asset class you thought these were. So Garnaut, for example, says he reckons they're a sort of asset that might have a 4% real rate of return. And so really when someone's doing a pricing calculation, they would be thinking about the total demand and supply of these across the linked markets and then imagining there'd be a forward price curve that would rise at 4% real. That's the implication of banking indefinitely. Now, there are a few other implications of banking indefinitely which are pretty significant. I've said that the government will make them property and you can bank them indefinitely. Now, that has a pretty strong implication about how hard it would be for a government to turn this scheme off once you've started it. So if you're thinking about government, what sort of pre-commitment a government made, this is a pretty big pre-commitment. I mean, I think the evidence you get from water markets is once you've created those sorts of property rights, changing your mind and changing the nature of those property rights is pretty difficult, not just politically but financially once you've created them as property rights. So that indefinite banking is a very important feature of the scheme. If you're a purist about this, you'd say, well, you can bank, why wouldn't you allow borrowing? Because in terms of what the atmosphere sees, carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere for a long time. So it doesn't really matter if it's 1 year or 2 year or 3 year. I mean, it's basically all hits the atmosphere. So in fact, in Garnaut's first report, he certainly talked about, you just think about this as a carbon budget. It doesn't matter where you use it within the budget, so you should allow borrowing as well as banking. The scheme doesn't intend to allow unlimited borrowing. And it's essentially a political economy argument. What does borrowing mean? It means use a future vintage to acquit your liability this year. Well, just imagine how the politics is going to play on this. Lots of people borrow from the future into the first few years, and it turns out that there aren't many permits left, you know, for year 2015. 2015 rolls around. Government has a line of industry reps at the door saying, to meet that emission target in 2015, we're all disappearing. What does the government do? Well, some governments say bad luck, but others might, in fact, say that's not politically sustainable. So unlimited borrowing almost sets up in advance a political dynamic that's going to be too difficult to handle. And so we don't think it's a sensible thing to do. We will allow limited borrowing, but that's more thinking about a little price squeeze that might occur around the compliance period rather than genuine long-term intertemporal borrowing. That's really the idea of having the limited borrowing there. Now, price cap. And this is where the whole story becomes more complicated. In a pure cap and trade scheme, you wouldn't have a price cap. You would just say, if I have a quantity target, because that's what I think is required for the environment, then I should let the price go to whatever is required to square that equation of ensuring I have the right level of emissions. The Green Paper does propose a price cap. It says the price cap should be set at a level that it's very low probability of actually biting. Now, why is a price cap there? A number of people have said to me, look, that price cap is a very market-unfriendly mechanism. Right? I'm actually not convinced it's market-unfriendly for the following reason. How credible is a commitment from a government to say that I'll let the price go to anything that will be required to meet the quantity constraint? Put a different way, if I have a $20 carbon price with the coverage that's proposed in the Green Paper and I auctioned everything, I would have about $9 billion of worth of revenue. Okay, broadly 0.75% of GDP. $40, 1.5% of GDP. $60, 2.25% of GDP. Now, whether I auction these things or give them away, the economic implication is roughly the same. Okay, I'm actually imposing that burden, even if I haven't, in a sense, when I give it to someone, I impose that burden and refund it to the person at that time. But if they can trade it, I, broadly speaking, have the same economic impact. So is it credible that a government is going to say, I will put no limit on the economic burden I'm prepared to put through this scheme over time? I don't think it's credible that they would say that. In the same way that it's quite topical at the moment, is it credible that the government would say, whatever happens to a major bank, I don't care? I'm talking about the US, of course. I can't comment on Australian policy in terms of the financial sector anymore. So it's not credible. So I think you've got to think about a price cap. It is actually saying to the market, look, this is where I need to set it as high as possible before the government is going to blink, in a sense, so that the market can operate. But it's a necessary part almost of saying, I've got to be realistic about what I'm going to do. And in fact, the worst thing for the credibility of the scheme is to say you'll do something and do something different. So in fact, it'd be more damaging if I said there's no price cap. And then in 2014, I said, actually, that's a bit uncomfortable. I'm going to go and do that, do something different. So that's really, I think, where you've got to think about the price cap. Now, the price cap can cause problems, though, because if I allow unlimited banking, but I allow a price cap, I've got a potential problem. Because what is a price cap? You can think about it as I will release an unlimited number of permits at the fixed price of the price cap. So suddenly, I've lost my pure quantity constraint on the nature of the permits in the market. Now, the proposal in the Green Paper is for a five-year time-limited price cap. And so that interaction between banking and price cap is important. Now, if the politics determine this has to be very low, then you clearly need to revisit banking, right? So you can only do banking if the price cap is at level that you really think it is reasonably unlikely you're going to hit that price cap. And that's always a key interdependence here, because if you think about a core bit of scheme design, you think of it from a financial market perspective, and you think about it in terms of setting up a forward price curve and setting up the right signals which allow you to make long-term investment decisions, banking's a pretty important feature. But if you look at a lot of the lobbying on the scheme, people are putting a lot of scenarios up where they're using quite high prices to make their case. And so there are pressures that the price cap should be lower than you might want from a pure market operation point of view. Okay. Linking with international schemes. Now, use of international credits can reduce costs. I mean, basically, an international scheme's allow you to buy a permit that says someone else isn't going to emit. This is the other key driver of the price in the domestic scheme. In fact, a lot of people have been talking about this scheme without thinking about international linking. Because you can imagine that there's a domestic abatement curve, if you like, the cost of doing domestic abatement, and there's an international price of abatement. If we're a small economy in terms of the international permit market, if you allowed unlimited linking, you imagine you sort of move up your domestic cost curve and then you just face the international price of permits. So there's a question about how much we should link. Kyoto consistency is important because that's really our international negotiations. If you buy a permit's not recognised internationally, then you get no credit for that in terms of your international schemes. And you don't want to link with any scheme that you actually think is not real abatement. You know, so you want to have confidence about the monitoring, reporting, verification. Because some people think about carbon markets as commodity markets. Right? You hear a lot of people talking about, you know, it's like a new commodity. It's not really like a commodity market at all. What you're really buying is faith in another regulatory regime. You know, this is an artificial market in that sense. It's not underpinned by how much coal is coming out of the ground. It's underpinned by how much you think another government or agency will report and verify the emissions entering the atmosphere. So you've got to be very careful linking. So the Green Paper said, look, preference for open links over time, allow Kyoto units for compliance. There's some initial restrictions on the types. Don't allow permits to be exported, transferred outside Australia. So in a sense, allow some imports, don't allow exports. Now, think about the price dynamics. Imports can only have a downward pressure on prices. Exports can only have an upward pressure on prices if you export at all. And this is really part of trying to get a measured start to the scheme, that you don't want to scare the horses too much by a price that starts too high. One of the ways you insulate yourself from that is not allowing exports to what might be a high-cost abatement market. And just with scheme caps, we give 5 years' notice, because if you've got a person want to put hard-earned cash down on should I buy a permit and bank it and make a financial decision, I want to have a bit of certainty that I don't know the government's going to change the rules of the game all the time. And this is particularly important because this isn't a commodity market. This is a constructed market, and you're really buying sovereign risk when you engage in this market. So the government has to be very predictable. And so we say 5 years' notice of a significant change in international linking policy. When I was AOFM, I thought to myself, one of the roles in AOFM is just to be as boring and predictable as possible. You know, difficult for me to do, I'd like to think. But it is one of those things that you don't want to be radically changing your mind the whole time. You want to be very consistent in what you do when you're running government bond markets, when you're running schemes that are regulatory. Now, I have to. I think I'm going to have to accelerate a little bit. Permit allocation. Mixing of auctioning and free allocation. Every cent goes back, balance the different interest. There'll be a climate change action fund, which is really a transitional assistance fund. Okay, so some of the money out of the permits goes in to help smooth that transition. But there's two classes of permit allocation at the start, which are a little bit different. The first is emissions-intensive trade-exposed industries. Now, there are two rationales for the emissions-intensive trade exposed. The first is so-called carbon leakage. With carbon leakage, the argument is, if I impose a carbon price ahead of the rest of the world, some industries will relocate. They will still do exactly the same production just somewhere else. Rather than produce it here, I'll import it. I get no change in global emissions, but I get a decrease in economic activity in Australia. How significant is this as an empirical question? Now, I think you need to think about existing investment and prospective new investment. When you're thinking about existing investment, particularly in the sort of industries we're talking about, big capital-intensive industries, there's a lot of sunk capital sitting in an existing plant. So if I've got an aluminium smelter, if I've got a cement production facility, a lot of existing capital. And if you think about it this way, at least for the facility, not necessarily for the current owner of that facility, let's imagine I had a product I sold for $100, but my variable costs are only $10. The rest of it's actually a return on this really large sunk capital. Well, a scheme at one level could extract $89 out of that $100. Nothing happens. Well, something happens to the owner, which they certainly will not find very pleasant. Something might happen to the superannuation fund that owns part of the asset. But in terms of carbon leakage, you don't get carbon leakage from that activity. For new investment, it's a little bit different, because obviously there's no sunk capital. You're making a clear decision, and you'd factor in the new carbon cost versus all the other costs to decide whether it's a proposition. So carbon leakage is one argument. Second is essentially just a general transitional argument. As I said before, we don't tend to turn the tap off in economic reform. So if I'm moving from not pricing carbon to pricing carbon, a lot of other things, we'd have a graduated introduction of the pricing of carbon. So there's some assistance for emissions-intensive trade exposed. We're going to allocate to new and existing firms that come in ETs. Target to activities based on industry average emission. So there's still an incentive to lower emissions if you find a better way of doing something. And conditional on the output of the activity. Now, you need that, because otherwise someone takes the permits and goes, you haven't solved your carbon leakage problem. Now, the key thing, and one of probably the most contentious things which you read directly and indirectly in the newspapers, is the government's said, well, we accept the emissions-intensive trade-exposed argument, but we're going to cap the number of permits that are available to this sector. Now, going back to my initial observation, if I carve out a sector, I increase the burden elsewhere. The best way to illustrate it is, imagine I start down on the left-hand side with an allocation, this is the total number of permits here, an allocation of the number of permits to the ET sector here. And let's say I said, I'll give you the same level of assistance per unit of output over time. I won't change that. As the ET sector grows, the absolute number of permits for that sector increases in line with the growth rate of that sector. If at the same time the national cap is declining, the proportion of permits taken up by the ET sector rises even more substantially over time. Or put another way, the emissions reductions burden that I've put on the rest of the economy increases much more substantially. Now, you can play around with a spreadsheet and with plausible growth rates. If you start with too high a level of ET assistance here, this becomes unsustainable very quickly. So you just think about it. Imagine GDP grows 3.5% and the ET sector grows at the same rate as the rest of the economy. And I'm starting in 2010, I'm growing for 10 years at 3.5%. If I started with, say, 50% of permits, you know, 50 with 3.5% growth rate, and then my cap's declining at the same time, suddenly I've got this just impossible, if you like, efficiency of GDP in terms of emissions in the rest of the sector. So what the government said is, okay, we're going to start with 30% of total permits allocated to ETs. We think that's a fair balance in terms of providing assistance but balancing this consideration about the burden on the rest of the economy. Then you go and say, okay, well, I need to ration that. So you come up with metrics of emissions intensity. So the emissions intensity is roughly going to match how many permits you have to buy. It's going to be the materiality of the impact. You set those permits, and that divides up the assistance. Then I reduce the assistance per unit of output over time to keep the share of permits broadly constant. Okay, so I have to think about what the growth rate of the ET sector is and the rate at which the cap declines, and have that as a factor by which the rate of assistance reduces over time. Now, we said we'll finalise the thresholds and rates of assistance based on consultation, because we did this on the basis of the best data we had available, but we can get much better data actually talking through the consultation process. Finally, the electricity sector. Coal-fired generators are potentially strongly affected by the scheme, and that's essentially because whilst electricity as a whole might be able to pass on the price to consumers, there are very different technologies for producing electricity. So brown coal is much more polluting than black coal, which is more polluting than gas, which is more polluting than renewables. So to the extent that a brown coal generator is unable to pass on the full amount of the price increase, there could be quite substantial changes in asset values. So the concern was that, to the extent, and this is one where everyone I've spoken to except those people who own generators is sceptical about this argument, so I'll just put that on the table now. If this policy change was unforeseen, so an extreme case, and if this change in carbon pricing, because of the nature of this industry, effectively wipes off a very large amount of asset value overnight, then what this could do is create a dynamic of greater sovereign risk in Australia. That is, the argument is that Australia now becomes a less attractive investment destination because people are worried that government will radically change policy overnight and you have to build a risk premium in future-looking investment. That's essentially the argument. So the government has said, recognising that some limited direct assistance will be provided to generators, the quantum hasn't been specified. Now, the difference between the limited direct assistance and the ETs, the idea is provides a lump sum once off. Okay, might be paid over time, but the decision would be once off. So the abatement incentives actually start from day one for the coal-fired sector. Because you had lump sum payment, you still face the full permit liability when you choose to do a polluting form of power generation. So some people after the Green Paper said, well, where's the abatement going to come from? You know, you've carved out the generators, you've carved out the ETs, etc., what's left? But in fact, in the generator sector, the full marginal cost of abatement hits you from day one. You just may have got a wealth transfer at day one, but that shouldn't change the marginal incentives. The ETs, there's partial assistance, and we link it to the average industry emissions, so you still have individual incentives to change emissions. Governance, I think that's the last thing. There's a lot of commentary about whether the government should be involved in setting the scheme caps, you know, because the people are concerned that if I have to set a new scheme cap every year, then won't politics get involved? That'd be very unstable. I suppose the argument the government's put, I think it's a pretty persuasive argument, setting scheme caps feeds into permit prices, so it's a bit like setting tax rates. You wouldn't normally allocate the setting of tax rates to the ATO. We could trial it, but it's not normally where you'd allocate that responsibility. You'd see that as an inherently a decision that's got to be taken by Parliament to balance off the competing interests across society. But there will be independent reviews every 5 years. Next step, Treasury modelling will come out at the end of this month. White paper, exposure draft legislation, medium-term target range by the end of 2008. Legislation by 2009, scheme start 2010. So that's where we're at. So I hope I didn't skip the bits that would make it intelligible.
No, I don't think so. And I think, given the importance of your contribution to this, I think we should make sure there isn't sufficient time for questions on this, because the green paper and the white paper and so on will be so crucial to people's understanding. So let's get straight into it.
One of the main criticisms of these cap and trade schemes is the potential over-allocation of permits, which sunk the EU scheme.
Yeah.
And with potential banking, surely that could aggravate the situation if a mistake was made in any year or any period. You could actually keep this over-allocation of the system for quite a while. So how is that going to be protected against?
2 points. The first point is the EU started the scheme without a mandatory reporting scheme in advance of it. So the Australian scheme starts with the National Greenhouse Energy Reporting Scheme, started 1 July this year, collecting mandatorily reported data, which will run for 2 years before the start of the scheme. So the risk of over-allocation is lower than it would have been in the EU scheme. That's the first point. Second point is banking actually helps you with over-allocation. The problem with the EU scheme is, let's imagine I'm just in this first, let's say it's as an EU, 3 years, and I've over-allocated, that part there. I've got no demand for permits above a zero price once people realise this for that whole three-year period. Now, if I over-allocate with banking, but I've got a trajectory that's sliding down, then the scarcity expected in the later period will actually maintain a positive price in the first period. Now, a couple of points here as well. People, for example, have looked at emissions targets, and I think a lot of them forget what business as usual is doing. So, for example, are the Garneau targets of -5% to -10% ambitious or unambitious? Now, it's more than my job is worth to answer that question at this point. But I make the following observation. Business as usual projections for 2020 already incorporating the fact we have a 20% renewable energy target, are 120% of 1990 levels. So in other words, if you're shooting for -5%, you're actually shooting for 25 percentage points below the business as usual scenario. So unless your financial markets are very myopic, if there's tightening later in the period, even if you got the allocation wrong at the start, that would work itself out of the system quite quickly and generate a positive price in the early period. The second thing that I can do is, because I've got banking helps rather than hinders, let's say I have got a very low price here, I've got to set scheme caps within this gateway. But if I see this over-allocation here or there's not much of a price, I'm much more inclined to head towards the bottom of the gateway as I go forward. And because of banking, every time I set an ambitious gateway or a more ambitious gateway than I could out here, I tighten the demand-supply conditions in the previous market. So I think there's a very strong argument that banking actually helps you with a potential over-allocation in the first period. And that is why, one of the reasons why banking is such an important design element. and why the debate about the price cap is so important, because if the price cap gets too low, you really have problems maintaining banking, and then you do run into some of the problems of the EU might have come if you've got over-allocation.
Kautai, you mentioned that there's a direct resistance to electricity sector. And can you elaborate a bit more why there's resistance to coal-fired generator and why not for other, like, gas-fired generators? Is there any issues of the definition of intensities, emission intensity?
Because almost certainly, I think if you read any of talk to anyone in the industry, they would expect gas-fired generators to make money. I've got a nice diagram that illustrates why that's the case, but the intuition goes as follows. If you think about what's going to happen to the price of electricity as a result of imposing a carbon tax, what's going to happen is you think of the supply of electricity from each type of technology. The supply cost rises by the amount of the permit liability that is imposed on each of those forms of generation. Now, in the case of brown coal generated electricity, roughly speaking, you produce 1.3 megatons of emissions for every megawatt hour. Black coal, 0.9, gas, 0.6. So if you think about very crudely what's going to happen, the price of electricity is going to rise by, say, a weighted average of the additional costs that have imposed upon each of those different forms of electricity generation, crudely speaking. If my permit liability is below that weighted average, then, in fact, the price I received increases by more than the permit liability that I now have to pay to the government. So, in that sort of weighted average world, it's pretty clear gas wins. Brown coal is a more ambiguous story. Sorry, black coal is a more ambiguous story. Brown coal tends to be a loser. Now, that's if you think about a weighted average. If you actually think about how the electricity market actually works, the way it works is there is a so-called dispatch order. So people bid into the electricity market basically on their variable costs. You stack the orders and then pay the price to the marginal generator who's paid the most, and everyone else gets the same price. So there is one scenario where brown coal is no worse off and everyone else is better off. If brown coal was effectively the generator setting the marginal price, they raise the price by their full permit liability, everyone else makes a windfall gain equal to the difference between the permits they have to buy because of the lower intensity and the amount brown coal had to buy. So in the electricity market, the question of who wins and who loses comes down to their relative intensities and who's actually setting the marginal price. So if black coal is setting the marginal price, they're broadly indifferent as to whether they're buying permits or not, because they just cover their permit costs. Brown coal loses, and when you think about that as a capitalised stream over a period of time, that could be substantial money. Gas wins. If gas is setting the price, gas is indifferent, okay, and the others lose. So that's why there's no suggestion of providing compensation to gas. Gas is a clear, almost certainly a clear winner. And when you look at the people commenting on this, you would notice that firms that tend to have a larger gas portfolio tend not to be too concerned about the transition. Those that have black coal, depending on, there are variations in black coal and there's difference in NEM markets, less concerned. Brown coal, very concerned, which is partly why Green Paper says pool of compensation for brown coal, pool of funding for black coal, separate and with slightly different, likely to be different quantums.
Thanks for that. There's a question waiting over at the far right there.
McLean AMP. I'm particularly interested in interaction with international schemes. And I guess my preface that with some comments. I think that if we're not linked with international schemes by 2050, we may as well all go and take cyanide pills now. I mean, you know. So it, to me, it seems to be almost a fundamental part of designing any scheme. You have to try and work in, and again, the problem is, of course, you don't know what an international scheme might look like. But I guess most analysis I've seen suggests if the world acted multilaterally, the overall cost of meeting carbon targets would be a hell of a lot less than acting if individuals acted unilaterally. Would you agree with that comment for a start?
Well, clearly, if the world's not doing something by 2050, we are in trouble. Right?
No, but have you done any modelling to look at the relative cost of acting by ourselves versus if we acted in concert with the world?
The Treasury modelling has modelled, and in fact Garnaut models, different scenarios of how the world moves on path. Now, it's not for me to release the Treasury modelling. All I'd make is the following observation. At least over the short term, some of this is not as clear-cut in the modelling for two reasons. The first is those models tend not to model the actual impacts of climate change. So the world moving and actually getting a better climate outcome tends not to feed into the sort of models that model the costs of these things. The second factor that you have to just be cautious about is, let's say, just take a scenario. I'm not saying this is in the modelling scenario. Let's say carbon capture and storage doesn't exist, just as a modelling assumption. And let's say the rest of the world moves substantially to cut emissions. What happens to Australian coal exports? No? They typically go down. So the story of exactly what happens in terms of the balance is a bit more complicated than you first might think. The costs to Australia are lowered by the rest of the world acting, because you need to worry a lot less about emissions-intensive trade-exposed industry because everyone's facing a carbon constraint. But paradoxically, for some industries in Australia, the rest of the world acting is essentially the rest of the world not demanding a range of goods that we export. So that those balance of considerations mean that it may be slightly more complicated than it first appears. Putting the modelling aside, it's clearly in Australia's interest for everyone to move. And in a sense, what the government's trying to do, both with thinking about targets and trajectories and thinking about the scheme, I actually think, for example, the scheme design is a credible pre-commitment that you have the capacity to hit much higher targets in the future. So when you're going across to a country and saying, we're prepared to commit to something, and by the way, we've got the architecture to deliver it, I think you've got a great more credibility than someone says, I'll set a target, how are you going to meet it? Well, we'll work it out when we get there.
That though, this is still on. I think in the design you described, where there's a ban on exports from Australia, I think that's got to only be a very short-term view. Then, is there any provision to perhaps revisit that aspect of the design?
Oh, it's clearly a transitional measure, so it's not intended. It's a long-term measure. I mean, I think you've got a balance here. The priority, I think, and the right priority is to get the scheme in and make sure it operates so you've got an architecture going forward. If that means you have to make a few design decisions which take out some, say, upside price risks to smooth the introduction, that's the trade-off. But longer term, you'd certainly want exports.
Okay, well, just this must be the last one, and Sonia, I think down the front here.
Thanks, Blair. Sonia Powell from Zohania. Question about the carbon leakage issue and assistance for new trade-exposed emissions-intensive... I got it the wrong way around. New ET facilities in Australia. I'm just wondering if the assistance that the scheme will be providing to them might have an unintended consequence of actually reducing the likelihood that those facilities could have been established in some developing country hydroelectric environment.
Well, I think the first point to make is it's not full assistance. It's not 100% of your permits. And that's probably an important consideration if it was a hydro source versus a non-hydro source. At the moment, the top tier is 90%, the second tier is 60%, but there's also that decay factor. Now, the government didn't specify what the decay factor was, but if you think about the implied, for an absolutely fixed proportion of permits, the decay factor might be somewhere between 3 to 5%, depending on what I think growth rates and the cap would look like, 3, 5, maybe 6. So if someone's doing a really long-term investment, they would have to factor in not just where the assistance is in day one, but where it's likely to be at 2020. Now, that argument cuts both ways for people who are saying that you're going to discourage investment in Australia, but it's important. The second thing is if it's a really emissions-intensive thing, I think that a lot of the big multinationals, and some have been for a long time, are almost looking beyond what current government policy looks like and saying, well, over the life of this investment, which might be 30 or 40 years or 50 years, I almost need to presume I'm going to have a carbon-constrained world. And even if it might look marginally better for the first 5-10 years, what does it look like 2020 and beyond or 2030 and beyond? So you can't rule out at the margin. It's going to make it more attractive than if you provide no permits. That's right. But whether it would detract a hydro person, I'm not so sure. And the really energy-intensive companies, a number of them have had globally policies for 15, 20 years to move to the lowest carbon areas just on the basis that they think the constraint will eventually arrive.
Okay, well, I've let it overrun 10 minutes or so, and I think it's time to draw a conclusion to that. But I'd like to thank Blair for a terrific presentation and for some really valuable insights into the emissions trading system that's coming about, not only how it will work, but why it was designed the way it is. So we all look forward to the next stage of the white paper. But in the meantime, thank you very much, Blair, for your contribution.